big question of this book. What is the question that God asks of man in this book? The question is, will you trust me? Right? That's the question in the Garden of Eden with Eve. Is he going to trust God and his word, or is he going to trust the snake and what he says? It's the question in Revelation where the rocks are falling down and the people refuse to turn to God, even in the hour of the darkest, most desperate hour. It's the question of the book of Isaiah. Isaiah is about faith. Will you trust God? And that's the thread that runs throughout the whole book, and we've been seeing it through the first 35 chapters. And now we're starting a new section today, chapter 36 through 39. These four chapters are a bit unique in the book. They're in the center of the book. There's something of the hinge of the book. They're the pivot on which the book pivots. And the question is, what will Hezekiah do? He's the person. He's the king. What will he do in light of everything that Isaiah has said? Isaiah's given him a zillion reasons, maybe not a zillion, but a lot of reasons to trust the Lord. And so now, the question is, what will you do? The Assyrian army has marched up against you. It looks impossible. But God has already shown you this and this and this, right? He's shown you that he's going to have a glorious kingdom. He's shown you that there's going to be a perfect king. He's shown you that the nations cannot be trusted. Remember all of these things we've talked about in previous chapters. So now, I mean, can you bank on that? Or you say, you know, we're gonna hedge our bets. We're gonna trust the Assyrians instead. Hezekiah is not the first guy. You can turn to chapter 36 if you haven't already. Hezekiah is not the first guy to be in this situation. His father, Ahaz, about 30 years earlier, was in a very similar situation. In fact, this is not something that Isaiah leaves sort of subtle. He actually draws our attention to it. We're going to be reading here in a second. But there's a place here that's mentioned. I'll just point it out to you right now in verse 2. Where the commander comes. It says the commander comes. And this is a little bit unusual what it says here. It's not a little. It's a lot unusual as far as I know. I know a lot about Jerusalem, and I know a lot about the places about where Jerusalem is described in the Bible. There are not very many specific descriptions. But here, it names a place, and it uses four different points of identification. It says, the commander came to the... He stopped at the aqueduct. Or actually, this is the NIV. And I think it says the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the washerman's field. Now, you read that at home, and you probably just keep reading. You're like, oh, okay. I don't know about that, and does it change the story, and I don't understand it, so, and I don't know where it is. I don't know where any of these things are. I don't know where the washerman's field is. I don't know where the road is that goes to the washerman's field, and I don't know where the aqueduct is, which is next to that leads to the upper pool on the road to the, we don't know where any of those things are today. No archaeologists do. I think it's on the north side of the city somewhere. So, I'm not going to solve that mystery. But, here's the point. The exact same place with those four terms are given in Isaiah 7. Where Hezekiah's father, Ahaz, Isaiah goes out to meet Ahaz. And Isaiah says to Ahaz, you're being attacked. Will you trust God or not? And Ahaz says, no. This is the Emmanuel passage, remember, where Isaiah is going to say, behold, the virgin will conceive and give birth, and you'll name him Emmanuel, and that whole story. But the point most directly related today is, Isaiah is saying, are you going to trust the Lord to deliver you from these kings? And Ahaz says, no, no, I won't ask the Lord for a test. And that's not a, he's not being pious there. He's actually, he's just, God had told him to do something and he's saying, no, I won't do it. And I won't trust the Lord. And I am going to trust Assyria. And so Isaiah says, okay, if you want to trust Assyria, they're going to come. They're not just going, yes, they will kill the bad guys that you want killed. They'll do that. But they're going to do something else. They're going to keep coming. They're going to be like a river that overflows its banks. And you thought you could control this river? No way, because it's just going to overflow into your land as well. That's what you get, Ahaz, for not trusting the Lord. You get Assyria. You think they're your deliverer. In fact, they're your conqueror. Now, 30 years later, Hezekiah is reaping the fruit of that decision because Assyria has come to town. And Assyria is conquering the land, and Assyria is going to overrun the land. And the question that Hezekiah has to make, the face, is, will I trust the Lord? Because it would be easier to trust Assyria. No doubt. Right? You can see the Assyrians. The Assyrians are telling you exactly what they're going to do. If you're going to believe God, but God's invisible, and you just have what some words of what his prophet says. That's a long introduction. Let's read. I didn't plan a long introduction. But who would like... This is a longer chapter. We're going to do it all today. And I think... Man, that's a lot. Should we really cover that much? But Jeff covered 10 chapters today. So. Yeah. Who would like to read? Let's just split it into two parts. If somebody will read verses 1 through 10, I'll volunteer. Okay. And then who will read 11 to the end? Okay, Sharon.
In the 14th year of King Hezekiah's reign, King Shemeshur of Assyria marched up against all the fortified cities of Judah and captured them. The king of Assyria sent his chief advisor from Lachish to King Hezekiah in Jerusalem, along with a large army. The chief advisor stood at the conduit of the upper pool, which is located in the road to the field where they wash and dry cloth. Elkiam, son of Hilkiah, the palace supervisor, accompanied by Sheben, the scribe, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the secretary, went out to meet him. The chief advisor said to them, "Tell Hezekiah that this is what the great king, the king of Assyria, says. What is your source of confidence? Your claim to have a strategy and a military strength, and military strength is just empty talk. In whom are you trusting that you would dare to rebel against me? Look, you must be trusting in Egypt, that splintered reed staff. If someone leans on it for support, it punctures his hand and wounds him. That is what the Pharaoh king of Egypt does to all who trust in him. Perhaps you will tell me, we are trusting in the Lord God, Lord of our God. But Hezekiah is one of those, is the one who eliminated his high places and altars. Then told the people of Judah and Jerusalem, you must worship at this altar. Now make a deal with my master, the king of Assyria, and I will give you 2,000 horses, provided you can find enough riders for them. Certainly you will not refuse one of my master's minor officials in trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen. Furthermore, it was by the command of the Lord that I marched up against this land to destroy it. The Lord told me, march up against this land and destroy it.
Then Eliakim and Shebna and Joah said to Rabshakeh, speak now to your servant in Aramaic, for we understand it, and do not speak with us in Judean in the hearing of the people who are on the wall. But Rabshakeh said, has my master sent me only to your master and to you to speak these words, and not to the men who sit on the wall, doomed to eat their own dung and drink their own urine with you? Then Rabshakeh stood and cried with a loud voice in Judean and said, hear the words of the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you. Nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. This city shall not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Do not listen to Hezekiah, For thus says the king of Assyria, make your peace with me, and come out to me, and eat each of his vine, and each of his fig tree, and drink each of the waters of his own cistern, until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards. Beware that Hezekiah does not mislead you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered his land from the hand of the king of Assyria? We are the gods of Hamath and Arpad. We are the gods of Sepharvaim, and when have they delivered Samaria from my hand? Who among all the gods of these lands have delivered their land from my hand, that the Lord would deliver Jerusalem from my hand? But they were silent, and answered him not a word, for the king's commandment was, do not answer him. Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, and Joah the son of Asaph, the recorder, came to Hezekiah with their clothes torn and told him the words of Rabshakeh.
Thank you. Well, that's an interesting story, huh? There are a lot of dialogue. This story continues in chapter 37. We're only doing half of it today. Come back next week to find out what happens, because right now we're on the edge of our chairs. What is Hezekiah going to do? Is he going to trust the Lord? What is God going to do? Is he going to deliver Jerusalem? That's the big question. Passing out the handouts now, and if you turn to the second page, you'll see an outline here. We can't cover everything in this chapter, but we will try to hit the most important points. We'll start with the setting. I mean, I told you that most of the story in chapters 36 and 37 is the talking. It's the speeches. We have two speeches by the Assyrian commander here. His name is, or his title is Rabshakeh. And the commander. That's what the NIV did that with it. Makes it so called him the field commander. I don't know if that's the right term. He's an official. We can say that. Actually, the word Rabshakeh, it comes from the word which means a wine taster. But he's probably more than just the guy. He's probably a close assistant, advisor, like Nehemiah was. So, in any case, he makes two speeches here, and then in chapter 37, we've got a long, well, it's not so long, we have a letter, and verses 9 and following, by the Assyrian, and then we have Isaiah's response. And so, if you're really interested in battle accounts, and by the way, this is one of the most important battles in Israel's history. If you're interested in knowing, like, where they went, who was fighting, how long it lasted, what was the outcome, what weapons they were using, all of that, you don't get it here. Because Isaiah doesn't care. Isaiah cares about the spiritual realities. He cares about who is greater. Sennacherib's setting himself up as God, as it were. There's interesting connections here. He's saying, don't trust your God to give you a good land. No, trust me, and I'll take you out to a good land. Just as one example. So this is Isaiah's point is concerning faith. And he doesn't give us all the background. But some of the background is helpful just to kind of get in that position. You can read these first few verses, and you just read them real fast, and you're like, okay, get to the dialogue. But it says... Excuse me, in the 14th year of Hezekiah's reign, that's 701 BC, if you're keeping track, Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, he had been king only for a few years at this time. He was an important king. He built a big, he made Nineveh a very important city, big capital. But here's the most important part here for us. He attacked all the fortified cities of Judah, and he captured them. Now, don't read that verse too fast. That's what's already happened when the rest of this comes to be. It's because he's already fought against these cities and conquered them, and now he's coming to Jerusalem and saying, you're the last one left. Why do you think you're going to be delivered? Now, I brought in a few pictures that will help to see the... Oh, it's dark.
Yeah.
I will turn the lights on after I show you the pictures, so you'll be able to see. And this is, my pictures are only for the first couple verses, and then we're going to be talking, the rest of the story we won't be using pictures, but this will help just to get a little sense for exactly what they were facing. I mean, it's one thing for you to say, you know, well, yeah, he could trust God because, you know, he had a prophet right there, or he had a, you know, he was living in the time of the Bible, or whatever. But if you really understand the gravity of the situation, I think when you see, like, if Hezekiah could trust God in this most awful situation, then you can trust God in whatever you're doing. Nobody here, and I know many of us have had tough times. None of us have ever faced what Hezekiah, not even close. It's not just his whole kingdom being wiped out. It's God's promises. You know, Abrahamic covenant we talked about today in church? I told Jeff after the service. I said, I think that the Abrahamic covenant is the most important thing that Christians don't understand. And I can't develop that all today. But I'll tell you that why am I saying that? Because I'm studying through the Old Testament this year, right? That's my job. And tomorrow I start on Habakkuk. That's not canonical order. But in any case, I've done a lot of the Old Testament. It just keeps coming up again and again and again. So Hezekiah is facing, are all of God's promises that he's going to multiply the seed, he's going to give us the land, he's going to bless us. This is all going to vanish if Sennacherib succeeds. If Hezekiah surrenders. Well, I mean, I'm not going to say that Hezekiah's failure is not going to cause God's failure. But, I mean, that's the stakes here. I've said a lot more than I planned to. But here's, and I know it's going to hurt me in a little bit. This is a map. I told you the Bible doesn't really tell us much about how Sennacherib comes. Although, this same account is in Kings and Chronicles. It's the only account, only story in the Old Testament that's given three times. We have a few stories in the New Testament given four times in the four Gospels, like Jesus' crucifixion. But nothing in the Old Testament given three times except for this, which tells you kind of important. Kings, Chronicles. But it's not, even Kings and Chronicles don't give us all of this detail that tells us Sennacherib came down. This is Jerusalem, by the way, and I'm not going to explain all this to you, but I just want you to see a lot of arrows, right? Wow, there's a lot of things going on. Sennacherib, he's conquered this, conquered this, conquered this, conquered this. And we know it because Sennacherib left a record. Not just one copy, six copies, probably more, but we found six. We have today six. I've seen at least half of those copies in different museums. And they describe his attack on Judah. And they describe how he made Hezekiah like a bird in a cage. Describes how he conquered 46 cities. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us 46. It just tells us, right, he conquered all of the fortified cities. Here it's 46. He gives us a number. Oh, how we wish he had written out the names of those cities. It would have been so helpful for guys like me who like historical geography. So now we know some of them, but we don't know all 46. And archaeologists, you know, try to fill in some of the gaps. So he's boasting, conquered this. You know, look how great I am. I drove out 200,000 people. He carried off in exile 200,000 people. That's a lot. Male and female, horses, mules, donkeys, camels. He made Hezekiah. He's speaking about in the context here himself is Hezekiah. I made a prisoner in Jerusalem. He made Hezekiah, and that's exactly what we got here. Hezekiah is under siege. And he made him like a bird in a cage. And it keeps going. And I put this here. I knew I wasn't going to read it. You're not going to read it either. But here's the point. He never says that he swallowed the bird. You know, the cat never ate the bird. He never describes the conclusion of the battle. He claims he got him like a bird. But then he goes on to something else. Which is to say, and everybody agrees, all scholars agree, that the Assyrian account agrees with the Bible's account in not attributing victory to Sennacherib. I mean, this guy will take victory anytime, everywhere, any chance he can get it. But he doesn't claim victory here because he doesn't get it. Now, again, to find out what what really happens. You have to read chapter 37 to come next week. But Sennacherib was really proud of his victory in Judah, but not over Jerusalem, because he didn't conquer Jerusalem. But he did the next best thing. The city that he conquered, he went back and in his palace that he built in Nineveh, in a throne room there, archaeologists call it room number 36, he decorated it with a relief, a depiction of what his of the battle against Lachish. So, again, I should say it this way. Actually, and when we read chapter 37, you see that the battle, that the pictures I'm going to show you right now, is occurring at the moment of chapter 36. This is what's going on exactly when the Assyrian leader official is saying, don't trust Hezekiah, don't trust the Lord. The archaeologists excavated these reliefs, and they carried them off to London. Now they're in the museum, in the British Museum, and you can go and see them there. Here's just a few pictures. These are the Assyrian archers of Sennacherib. You can see their bows and arrows, and you can see their clothes, you can see their helmets, you can see their legs, and their feet and their sandals. And here's the spearmen. You can see their shields and their spears and their skirts and slingers. This is a drawing of slingers. A little easier to see some of the details with a drawing. Archaeologists have found at Lachish, the city where this occurred, sling stones. The same sling stones which are being depicted by Sennacherib. A friend of mine found a sling stone there. There were a lot of them, right? The slingers, that was just part of the army. That was like, you know, you got the Army, Navy, and Marine Corps. Well, they had the archers and the slingers and the swordsmen. And so here's they built a siege ramp. Archaeologists found the siege ramp going up to the city. So this is all background. It's not described in the Bible about how he conquered Lachish. It just says he conquered all these cities. But Hezekiah knows this. I'm next, right? I mean, that's what Sennacherib's saying. You don't surrender, we're going to do to you what we did to all those other cities. And that was pretty intimidating, pretty scary. Now, the Judeans had defenders. Here's some of them up there, and they're throwing things down. And ultimately, of course, it failed. Some of the Judeans, my projectors will aim a little high here, but these guys here didn't fare so well. These Judeans got stuck on a pole. These ones here had their skin ripped off while they were alive. Others of them were carried off into exile. Yeah, I have my daughter here. These pictures are rated PG-13. But these are Judeans who are being taken away. Captive, including families, including animals. Remember, the inscription said he carried off all these animals. Families. See the little child here? Goodbye, Judah. So he's off moving to Assyria. So that's the reality. That's what they're facing. That's what Jerusalem is up against. This is Sennacherib himself. He depicted himself sitting on a throne. With people, his attendants, air conditioning behind him. Somebody later chiseled out his face. Probably one of his successors. Probably chiseled out in ancient times, not modern vandalism. But now, just a couple of slides here, just a few slides. I mentioned to you this aqueduct at the upper pool on the road to Washerman's Field. We don't know where that is. But when you know a little bit about Jerusalem, namely, it's got Big Valley on the west side and south side. My north arrow is off the edge here, but that's north of this way. And then there's a Big Valley, Kidron Valley, you're familiar with that, on the east side. So Jerusalem has one good side to approach it. That's the north side, and almost certainly the Assyrians came at it from that way. They're going to have their camp on the north side. Here's a map of the city in the time of Hezekiah. So the Assyrians are probably camped up here, and this is the city that Hezekiah. The temple, of course, is here. That's going to be mentioned in chapter 37 next week. archaeologists found part of the wall that is on the north side. It's a huge wall. It's about 25 feet thick. They call it the broad wall because of its size. And there's a broad wall mentioned later in the Bible. So it could be that, you know, it talks about the people are on the wall. They could be on this wall or somewhere near here, and they're listening, and the Assyrian guy is saying, don't listen to your king, because you're going to have to eat your own filth. Don't let him call the shots. So, oh, one other thing in here too. Just interesting to note in verse 3, and these are hard words to pronounce, hard names to pronounce, and just kind of skip over them, but just a little interesting thing in here. Do you remember in Isaiah 22, there was a Judean official named Shebna who Isaiah condemned? He says, you're a bad guy because you're chiseling your tomb out in the height. And remember, I showed you this picture. It looks kind of junky, but that's where it is in Jerusalem today. It's in a dangerous part of town. I've only was there once in my life when I took this picture. But this up here was the inscription, which mentions a man who was the royal, it's called the chief of staff. And most scholars agree that this was where his tomb was. So Isaiah says, the guy who builds his tomb, he's taking care of himself. He's not taking care of the Lord's work. He's going to be judged and demoted. Well, guess what you have here? This is the inscription. And I mentioned it before in chapter 22. But so he was over the house. That's another way of saying he's the chief of staff, is, I think, is probably the best explanation. But Isaiah said, you're going to get taken down, but Eliakim is going to be raised up, and he's going to be take your place. He's going to get your job. And that's what we have in this chapter here. We have the fulfillment of that. See how Shebna, he had been the palace administrator. Now he's the secretary. And Eliakim is... So it's just interesting, and it's easy to miss this detail in the big book, but a little detail of how Isaiah's predictions, short-term, are fulfilled. That's the background. The good thing is, if you're looking at the clock and saying, wow, we got a lot to cover. The good thing is a lot of it's pretty... You don't need much explanation for it, I think, because it's pretty self-explanatory. But let me draw your attention to the first speech in verses 4 through 10. The Assyrian official says, let me contrast the first speech with the second speech. The first speech, he says, this is what you need to tell Hezekiah. And he doesn't, by the way, call him king. He just says, he treats Hezekiah like he's just a lowly guy compared to his great master. He calls him, this is what the great king says. You're not a king, Hezekiah, but this is the great king. Of course, in the Bible, or in Isaiah rather, who's the king, right? So that there's a contrast going on here. But in the first speech, tell Hezekiah, you better surrender. Then in verses 11 and 12, the Judean leaders, Hezekiah's not there, the Judean leaders who are going to go relay the message back, they say, you know, do us a favor, talking to the Assyrian official, can you just speak in the official diplomatic language? Because we don't really want all these people to understand what you're saying. Right? The Aramaic, he says, speak to him in Aramaic, because the people won't understand Aramaic. I don't know. The parallel today, English is the lingua franca of the world. So, if you go in another country and they say, oh, don't speak in the native tongue, just speak in English. And so in the second speech, he's talking to the people. So, Hezekiah, don't trust your God. People, don't trust your God. Or don't trust Hezekiah. Don't trust Hezekiah, who wants you to trust your God. By the way, too, talked about military intelligence. It's going on here. The Assyrians have good military intelligence. Did you notice that when we read through? Well, verse 6. They know that Judah is tempted to trust in Egypt. They also know that Egypt is worthless. And now Isaiah had been telling them that before. Remember in chapters 30 and 31, Isaiah is saying, don't trust Egypt. And the Assyrians say the same thing. Egypt's not going to help you. You can send all your money down there. Remember all the camels going down through the desert? It's going to be a waste because they can't help you. They have their military intelligence. You see it in verse 7. They say, these guys are slick and sly and devious. They say, they know that Hezekiah has made reforms. They know that he has gotten rid of all the high places that are wrong. But they turn it against to say, oh, but the gods are going to be upset because you tore down the places to worship them. And undoubtedly there were people, for sure, I mean, why did the people go to the high places to begin with, right? I mean, they believed in them. They trust. And Hezekiah said, no, it's all wrong, right? God had already told us what his will is. We have to get rid of those and only worship at the temple. Well, some of those people, Hezekiah did that. Some of those people are like, oh no, we're gonna get in trouble with God. So the Assyrians play right into that. They try to use that to get the people to question Hezekiah and to say that was a bad move, and now God's going to be upset with us, and we're going to lose the battle. Of course, he mocks them in verses 8 and 9. There's more military intelligence going on in there, but maybe I'll drop that idea for now. What else in this first speech, anything else you want to comment on or ask a question about? Verses 4 through 10.
What about the Lord's approval?
Very good. Yeah, that's like the most important verse in the speech. What do you think about that?
It was kind of the ultimate discouraging thing to try to tell them. I mean, it's maybe kind of a mischaracterization of what was going on, but to couch it in those terms was designed to do nothing but directly challenge their faith. And in the ultimate sense, we don't really know what God's will is, so when someone starts claiming that, it's kind of hard to counter it if they're confident about it.
Yes. However, in this case, they did know. I mean, Isaiah had been revealing a lot of God's will, right? So when you go back, and this is a question that I don't know that we can definitively answer, but I tend to lean on this, lean one way on this, that I think the Assyrians knew Isaiah's prophecies, right? What did Isaiah said when Ahaz failed to believe? He says, well, the Assyrians are going to come and conquer you. So he's just quoting Isaiah to him. But he's quoting it partially and selectively. He doesn't say the reason why Assyria is coming is because you didn't trust God, and therefore the wisest course of action would be for you to trust God. Right? He's saying, selective quotation makes it very easy to give the opposite meaning.
I'll give you an example. Someone just shared with me at supper last night that he was getting some flack from his friends. Why do you conservatives always complain about the federal government, blah, 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 and now you're complaining that the federal government didn't do enough to solve this Gulf oil leak thing? I mean, it's like an attempt to flip the tables on something that we espouse, And my friend's going, well, now, wait a minute. There are instances, and this is one of them, but this is an example of that.
Yep.
Kind of flipping.
But they also haven't seen his deception because he said they tore down the altars of God, but those weren't God's altars.
That's right.
So, the problem today, too, is with political correctness, is
you may have the same vocabulary, but you have a different dictionary to define
right.
it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean,
nope.
don't believe them.
Nope. Good. Let's go to the second speech. We've seen the Judean officials' response to the first speech, like, this is getting too close to home. We really don't want you demoralizing the people. That's the whole goal, right? That's what's going on here. The Assyrians, they don't want a long siege. They just want them to march out with their hands up, surrender, and we'll deport you. But we've got this long siege going on right now at Lachish, and Lachish is very heavily fortified. Well, so is Jerusalem, that wall 25 feet thick. So they don't want to... How long would it take to conquer Jerusalem? Well, when the Babylonians do it 100 years later, it's a couple years long. They're just I want to avoid that. So what we just got to get them to surrender. But when the Romans conquered Jerusalem in the first century, it took them 4 years. You know, they weren't working on it the whole time, but a good while.
When was the last time that God had really delivered Israel in the time frame? Was it like 200 years before or 50 years? You know, because I want to try to put it in context.
Like you're talking about the most immediate sort of miraculous intervention?
Yeah, yeah. Would that be like Asa?
Well, certainly you have Asa. That's 150 years earlier. You have others too. I just have it take me a while to go through the history.
That's okay. I was just kind of curious. As to, you know, would the grandparents remember, you know, God's deliverance, or would it be something like, you know, our Revolutionary War?
Yeah, no, their grandparents would, because Hezekiah's great grandfather, Uzziah, had a great kingdom and a lot of victories, and that was because of a turnaround that the Lord brought. Okay, so in the second speech, you know, it's so so interesting. I mean, these guys know what the Assyrians, that is, the Assyrians know what their greatest obstacle is. What is it? That they will trust the Lord. Because if they trust the Lord... So that's what they've got to undermine. And the question here is how will not only the king, but the people, because the people could revolt, they could overthrow the king, or they could just march out themselves and say, we surrender. But how will all of them respond to what Isaiah's been teaching? Right? We've been going through this, you know, for how many months now? Through Isaiah? And sometimes, I don't know if you felt, I hope you haven't, but, you know, like, man, he keeps saying the same thing. Well, yes, he does. Isaiah keeps saying, trust the Lord. He is trustworthy for all of these reasons. And now is the test. So that's the point of attack. And he says, Hezekiah is deceiving you. They're getting out early. Don't listen to them. But look what I'll do for you. Oh, this is so helpful. Verses 16 and 17, right? The inducements of sin, right? The promises that sin holds out. Like, don't trust the Lord. If you trust me, Sennacherib, I'll meet your needs. I'll do everything God said he would do for you, but he's not doing for you. I will give you, and the picture here of a vine and a fig tree, it's one of my favorite images in all the Bible. It's mentioned a number of times. Just the picture, every man sitting under his own vine and his own fig tree and the fruit that you get, and it's a picture of rest and peace. I'll give you that, Sennacherib says. Any other thoughts? Oh, then verses 18 and 19. He says, you can't trust your God because none of the other gods save their people. None of them could protect them from us. And you're going to be just like, what's the problem? What's the underlying false assumption? Yeah. But that's the whole point that Isaiah's been making. Right? Is Yahweh, the Lord God of Israel, is superior to all of those others. They don't even exist. They're wood and they're stone. Okay, so we stop there. To be continued. Next week, we'll find out what happens. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for this encouragement. We're, all of us, I mean, our lives are characterized by this pull, whether we're going to trust you and your word and your promises or not. You know, we're going to be deceived and misled and to believe the lie of the devil, the lie of our flesh. And just a good lesson in that earlier today from the life of Abraham. And now again, very clearly we hear your word speaking to us, and we want to mentally commit right now to trusting you, to acknowledging that you are worthy of our trust, that you will come through, that every promise of yours is true and will not fail. But we ask you, Lord, to help us to act on that, to live that out, to make the small daily choices consistent with our beliefs, with our commitment. So we need your Spirit to do that through us. We need your Word to be a daily reminder and encouragement of that too. So we thank you in Jesus' name.
Amen. Real quick, John and Jessica, Ken and Jessica, good to have y'all back with us. Carol, it was